Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Last week's programme generated a lot of comments online. Thanks to all of you who took the time to share your thoughts. The responses were to Gary Taubes arguing that why we get fat is more than a simple energy equation of calories in and calories out, plus the remarkable story of a medical specialist on the Sunshine Coast who developed insulin-dependent diabetes and has wrangled it into partial submission with a very low-carb diet. Later on in today's show, a leading diabetes specialist comments. Plus, holding up a video mirror to doctors and nurses to help them look after patients more safely. And speaking of safety, a disturbing study looking at how well or poorly the Australian healthcare system treats people who are either having a heart attack or about to have one. It's called the acute coronary syndrome. One of the people who led the research was Derek Chu, who's Professor of Cardiology at Flinders Medical Centre in Adelaide.
It is a heart attack or a threatened heart attack, symptoms that result from a narrowing of the coronary vessel.
So give me typical stories that would make somebody think themselves that they might be having an acute coronary syndrome or a doctor or nurse looking at them.
They would often experience chest discomfort, chest pain, tightness in the chest or the throat, often can be in the arms or shoulders. Sometimes it would come on with exertion. More often in an acute coronary syndrome, it occurs at rest. And we see it more often in winter than in summer because of the colder weather causing spasm of the arteries around the heart.
Now, when I was a lad at medical school, there was a thing called crescendo angina, people who got chest pain on exertion, which got worse and worse and worse. That's not used anymore, but it's now part of the acute coronary syndrome.
Absolutely. It is a very classical pattern. It is a description of how angina can go from a stable pattern where a person experiences the same degree of chest pain on the same degree of exertion. And then suddenly it might become more frequent at lower thresholds of exertion, which really signifies that something acute has happened to the plaque in the arteries. And if we leave that going, potentially leading to a heart attack.
So somebody's sitting at home, they either have got this unstable angina or they've got chest pain or tightness or symptoms indicating their heart. What's the evidence about what they should do and what should happen when they hit the hospital to get the best outcome?
We know that the first thing that a patient should do is call an ambulance. Being assessed by an ambulance service at your doorstep as opposed to being driven to the hospital in your own private car is associated with less risk of arrhythmias that aren't treated. So people will survive to come into hospital much more frequently if they use the ambulance service rather than coming under their own transport.
And certainly don't queue up to see your GP that afternoon.
Absolutely. We still have evidence to say that people wait too long before they actually arrive to emergency medical services.
Now, some states in Australia, the paramedics are taught how to do what's called a 12-lead ECG, and if the person qualifies for clot busting it, giving it in the ambulance itself to shorten the time to treatment. Is that part of the evidence base?
Absolutely. In fact, there are several studies now that have demonstrated that if you can get clot busting medications to patients before you arrive to an emergency department, you can decrease the amount of heart muscle damage that is happening, but importantly also reduce the risk of dying from that heart attack.
Was that one of the criteria you assessed in this study?
This study was very much looking at the whole system of how people are looked after throughout the country. So we did evaluate whether or not there were people who were getting what's called pre-hospital, before-hospital fibrinolysis, those clot-busting medications, versus angioplasty to open up the arteries, versus clot-busting medication given the emergency department, compared to those who are not getting anything at all.
So you arrive at the emergency department. What's supposed to happen then in a well-oiled machine that's giving you diagnosis and treatment according to the best evidence?
The first things that should happen, obviously, are receiving an ECG to confirm the diagnosis again, getting basic medicines such as aspirin and other blood-thinning medications. And then,
just before you go on, just at that point, if you imagine the typical ECG wave is QRST, the last two bits of the complex are raised above the midline, if you like. And that's the situation of a sort of person who needs to be clot-busted.
That's right. So in people with ST segment elevation, a specific type of heart attack, those patients, we don't need any other evidence that the patient is having a heart attack. That is a sign that we need to act now. And international guidelines say that if you are going to try and open that artery with clot-busting medications, you've got 30 minutes to try and get that done. And if you're going to do it by angioplasty, you've got 90 minutes.
Using a catheter going into the heart and ballooning it up and then putting in a stent. And did you follow that through? Because one of the other things that is part of the evidence is you might have had one artery where there's a problem, but in fact, the classic story of holistic care, it's your whole heart that's diseased, your whole body that's got a problem here, and you need certain drugs and interventions after you've had the problem.
Absolutely. Part of our goals in treating this heart attack is trying to prevent the next one. We know that patients who have one heart attack have about a 25 to 30% chance of having another heart attack in the next 5 to 10 years. And we know that our therapies that we institute after admission and certainly by the time of discharge have been associated with reduced future heart attacks and reduced mortality. And making sure that patients understand their disease, understand the therapies that we are trying to give them, and also understand the lifestyle factors that have contributed to the heart attack on this occasion and what they can do to help modify these, is a critical part of the care that we have shown really is still suboptimally applied here in Australia.
Now let's double back to, you've hit the deck, literally hopefully not the deck, but you've hit the door of the emergency department, hopefully not being ramped in your ambulance. You get in the door, they do the ECG, and there's no ST elevation, but you've got all the signs of an acute coronary syndrome. What's the evidence base for what you do next? Because you're not allowed to get clot busting in that situation.
That's correct. And so what we then do is we look for evidence of heart muscle damage in the blood tests, and sometimes that takes between 4 and 8 hours.
And if they are, then you go for your clot busting?
Or angioplasty? Then need to have a look at the arteries with an angiogram and then from there decide.
Okay, so what you did then was an audit of a reasonable number of hospitals in Australia to see how well they were performing.
Right. We can no longer really think of this as being a doctor in an emergency department or in a cardiology unit simply applying their craft. We need to have a much more broad, systematic view of how we deliver those services.
The system's got to work like a well-oiled machine.
And it has to work for people in the country, and it has to work for people in the outer metropolitan areas of our big cities, and it has to work for the culturally diverse community that we have who have challenges in accessing care because of language or transport or cultural barriers.
So you surveyed nearly 300 sites, 4,500 people. What did you find?
What we found was that there is still a difference in the type of care that you receive depending on the type of hospital. And in fact, even amongst the different states of Australia, there are differences in the care that is received by patients with very much the same conditions. We found that a quarter of the patients needed to be transferred from one hospital to another. In fact, in total, the patients in this two-week period, only 2 weeks, had a total transfer distance of 140,000 kilometres, which is 3.5 times the circumference of the world.
So is this from small country hospital to large referral centre?
Many of them are from small country hospital to inner city hospitals. Some of them were between public and private systems. In some places, some patients had to be transferred between 3 and 4 hospitals to get them to appropriate care.
You're kidding. So you might have been having a heart attack and you're spending your time in an ambulance going from pillar to post.
That's true.
Was there a standout state?
Which state performs well?
Yeah.
Well, I can't really say what we have done.
Because you want to go back and do another study and they won't have you back again.
Well, this is true. I mean, this was an enormous...
But the public's got a right to know, Derek.
Well, the public does have a right to know in every sense. It's hard to say that there is a standout state on one issue.
Like Queensland and pre-treatment.
Correct. For example, WA has a much higher rate of angiography. New South Wales does well on the time to fibrinolysis, so blood clot busting medication in hospital. What is more important is that hospital services from state government down to local area networks, down to hospitals' individual practices, need to be standardised.
So what you're saying is that there are islands of good things, but the good things are a bit random. You're getting random variation almost.
That's true.
And scary.
An issue that we'd really like to address. And this initiative, I have to say, was a very strong collaboration between the state governments and the Australian Commission for Quality and Safety in Healthcare. And I have to say that the biggest contribution really was from the hospitals themselves.
I mean, did you grade it in terms of percentage of people getting really unacceptable care and which increased their chances of dying or significant damage? versus minor variations, which would be nice to have but are not going to make a big difference?
It's always a little bit hard to be clear about what the minor difference versus a major. If you were to look at ideal care in patients without ST elevation myocardial infarction, then only about 8% of people get everything that is possible.
8%?
Yes, 8%. But if you would then include those who might be missing one or two components of ideal care, then that rapidly rises to about 60% of the population. If we are looking at patients with ST elevation myocardial infarction, so a clearly identified heart attack on the ECG, we find that most people would get reasonably adequate care. They might miss one or two of the current guideline therapies. Having said that, only about 17% of patients will get absolutely everything that one might define as being perfectly ideal care.
What are the causes of this variation? Is it the usual thing in medicine that doctors prize their clinical freedom and they say, look, it's my judgment here? Women often get inferior care versus just that well-oiled machine hasn't been organized and people aren't talking to each other?
It's almost certainly a contribution of all three of those things. Acute coronary syndrome care requires close and careful integration of services down to the clinical expert that is looking after the care of that patient. There is no doubt that there is some variation in how clinicians assess and evaluate risk and benefit, and there is also variation in what patients want. It is not unheard of for country patients to say they don't want to go to the big smoke to receive invasive care.
That's quite common in Aboriginal patients. They don't want to leave the community.
But there is also no doubt that variation in the expertise of the people that are initially assessing these patients and access to expert opinion and care diminishes very rapidly once you leave the big cities of Australia and New Zealand. And the consequence of that is that some of the decision-making could be improved by remote means.
So, Derek, I'm giving you the magic wand. What are you going to do about it?
Well, the wand has already been waved.
So the fairy dust is being sprinkled, but where?
The Commission for Quality and Safety are developing national standards for what acute coronary syndrome care should look like. We are about to go through another iteration of the guidelines for how care should be provided. We are having dialogue with the states and territories about how we collect future data about acute coronary syndrome care so we can continue to monitor care. We're also studying how we can improve the clinical risk assessment of patients and whether or not that clinical risk assessment of patients leads to improved care and improved outcome. And that will potentially then feed into the emergence of electronic decision support systems to help junior doctors and less experienced doctors use objective means of evaluating risk.
And indeed some small country hospitals in Queensland which aren't fully staffed are now linked by telehealth, and
that's
you
right.
Can have an ED physician at the Royal Brisbane helping them out in a remote part of the state.
Certainly that is already also happening in my own state in South Australia, and we've got data to demonstrate that those sorts of services do improve care and improve outcome as well.
That was Derek Chu, who's Professor of Cardiology at Flinders Medical Centre in Adelaide and is also the Regional Cardiology Director. You're listening to the Health Report here on Radio National with me, Norman Swan. Now, to follow up on that, what do you do about this sort of situation? How do you get changes in the healthcare system? Well, could it be that one of the answers is actually to film doctors and nurses in action in real life? Well, that's what two researchers from the University of Technology Sydney are doing. In fact, they've just written a book on it called Visualising Healthcare Practice Improvement. Welcome to Rick Adema and Catherine Carroll to the Health Report.
Thanks, Norman.
Thank you.
Catherine, what is this technique?
Well, video reflexive ethnography is essentially bringing video into wards in hospitals and filming what people do in everyday practice.
So it's like anthropology in action?
Yes.
And do patients allow that too?
Yes, in some projects patients are involved.
So Rick, the background to this is what? I mean, where did this come from? Because most people, when they do studies trying to solve problems like the one we've just heard, which is an enormous problem from the ambulance service through to how you get care in hospital and how you communicate from rural hospitals in, they're massive problems, data-based, which is what Derek Chu was just talking about.
I think what we often misrecognize is the fact that what people are doing as part of these processes is not very often conscious for those people. And that if we film what goes on and we sit people down, they're able to see solutions that we hadn't been able to see before or even design before on the basis of the data and the evidence that we have. Generally, there is an over-reliance on cognition. We believe that once...
So rational thought.
Rational thought, rational evidence, the survey data, etc. Because we believe that once we have that knowledge, that we'll be able to fill the gap and get things happening. But that's not the case. If you look at what frontline people do, they're often acting out of some kind of habituated routine without being fully aware of what that is. And they really need to see themselves doing what they're doing to be able to get a grip on that routine, be able to redesign it.
So you could have all the fancy ideas in the world, but it all falls apart, Catherine, when somebody, one human being talks to another.
Well, the good thing is that people who we film have all the fancy ideas themselves. We don't necessarily come in and say, this is what you need to do.
Give me a description of an aha moment that you've experienced in your research.
This methodology has been used all over the world now. When I trialled this method in the United States, I was actually filming NICU, neonatal intensive care units, focused on how donor breast milk is being prescribed for preterm infants, because this is a critical food that's required ahead of formula when babies can't receive their mother's own milk. And in one particular unit, parents were being asked to pay for donor milk, and this very much influenced prescribing patterns of the neonatologists for donor milk. I attended these ward rounds on a daily basis and filmed the way physicians prescribe donor milk.
And what was happening with the prescriptions?
Well, what I found was that because parents were being asked to pay for donor milk, physicians were beginning to become increasingly reluctant to prescribe this substance as was medically recommended.
And they hadn't realised it? They didn't have the insight?
No. This is the thing, is that as Rick was saying earlier, it's habituated. They're so busy, they're just chasing their tail, and sometimes everyday practices aren't clear to the people involved in them.
And how did they respond when they saw the video of themselves?
Well, we provided basically a 2 or 3 minute clip of one particular case study, and people started shaking their heads and saying, this is not the organisation we want to be. And as a result of that, they went right up to hospital administration levels and requested that funding be made available for this program. And donor milk in this particular hospital is now made free for all babies who need it.
And Rick, another area where the system falls down is what's called handover, where you're in an emergency department or an intensive care unit and the shift changes and you've got to communicate important information about patients so that there's no gap in care. And you've been filming that.
Yes. People who are engaged in these handovers will see themselves being very tired, not remembering critical information about, for example, how much morphine they administered to a particular patient. They will see that their handovers are being interrupted by people who will be talking to people who are actually part of the handover team.
There's second conversations going on in the background, not listening to the handover.
Absolutely, that's what happens very often. And somehow these things are taken for granted. But when people see this on video, they say, like Catherine mentioned earlier, that's not the organisation we want to be. We should be doing this differently. Suddenly they become experts at reconfiguring and redesigning what they do. This is the paradox of this particular approach. And so it is the practitioners themselves who take that video footage, and it only needs to be about a minute or so, because they can see all sorts of opportunities and solutions for taking their practice into a different direction.
And people aren't embarrassed, Catherine, that they might be caught out?
No, that's made very clear.
So trust is a really important part of this.
That's exactly right. We spend a lot of time building trust relationships before even going into the field and starting filming. Clinicians have ultimate right of when to film and when not to film. And certainly we always take a very competency-based approach to our filming, looking for the good aspects of care.
So do you need two academics from an august institution to come in and do this for you, or can you just buy a cheap camera and do it for yourselves?
Absolutely, and that's our whole point. This is about research skill transfer to clinicians at the front line, because they need to become smarter doing this themselves.
So if you want to find out more, you're going to have to get the book. It's called Visualising Healthcare Practice Improvement, and it's published by Radcliffe. And two of the authors, Rick Adema of the University of Technology in Sydney, Catherine Carroll, about to go to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Congratulations. Thanks for joining us on the Health Report. And here, just for your edification, is an example of one of these very noisy interactions.
On the floor, he was just in preferred pain, so he had indomethacin and took about 20 morphine and 5 milligram lots too.
How long ago did he have the morphine?
I'm not sure what time his last one was. It took 20 basically straight away to get him down.
What time vaguely?
Probably about 1 o'clock would have been.
So he's been pain free for
He went to sleep and he had 5.
And when you see, that was the video actually that Edema was talking about, when you see the actual video of that interaction, the poor exhausted junior doctor is trying to explain himself while in the background two clinicians are having another conversation. It's not it's not actually that remarkable, but they weren't listening at all. Impressively, though, as Rick suggested, there was another video, which I'm not playing to you, but when the team saw what was happening, they changed the way they carried out the handovers to ensure there was effective and safe communications. It's pretty impressive. Now let's get back to last week's health report and the story of Dr. Troy Stapleton, a medical specialist on the Sunshine Coast who claims to be controlling his type 1 diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, much more effectively on a very low-carb diet compared to the standard diabetes diet he was being encouraged to eat. That and another interview on the show which questioned whether high availability carbs like sugar were the real culprits in the obesity epidemic, and they both generated a lot of interest. And of course, the question arises of the relevance to type 2 diabetes. Well, to give the perspective of a diabetes specialist, here's Martin Camp, an endocrinologist in Brisbane, president of Diabetes Queensland and past president of the Australian Diabetes Society.
We need to be very careful in interpreting one person's experience and applying it across the health sector.
But it's not just one. I mean, there's an endocrinologist in the United States called Richard Bernstein who's written widely on this.
Yes, that's true. I think it's important that we actually start by talking a little bit about what type 1 diabetes is. Quite often, type 1 and type 2 spoken of almost as if they are one condition. Type 1 diabetes occurs most commonly in younger people, but can in fact develop virtually at any age, is a condition in which the body is not able to make sufficient insulin. That is the condition, pure and simple.
It's an insulin deficiency.
So if we could, we would treat it by replacing insulin in the way the body gives us insulin in the first place. Unfortunately, we are not able to do that. We are just not as clever as the body cells that control the blood glucose level, the sugar that we have circulating in our bloodstream for energy. We are not as clever at adjusting the insulin in anticipation of changes or in reaction to changes in the blood glucose. So it's for that reason that we recommend various ways of approaching eating, and indeed exercise, and other aspects of people's lives.
But there is this paradox, which is the main purpose of insulin when you've got an insulin deficiency is to deal with the carbohydrate that you eat. And if you reduce the carbohydrate that you eat, you reduce the demand for insulin, and therefore the fluctuations in theory become less, which very, very crudely is the theory behind the low-carb diet or the very low-carb diet and type 1 diabetes.
I think it's important to remember, though, that we're actually trying to help a person live with diabetes. So what we attempt to do is actually allow people to continue to live their life the way they wish, eat the way they wish. We will definitely try to influence the way people eat and then adjust the insulin to it, which after all is what the body does for everybody who does not have type 1 diabetes.
So Martin Camp, the weakness in your argument is that people with type 1 diabetes have very high risk of heart attack later in life, albeit it's reduced if you can keep your blood sugar under control, very high risk of small blood vessel damage, which damages your eyes and your kidneys and so on, even with high quality care. And isn't that Troy Stapleton's argument and Richard Bernstein's argument, is that you might like to continue your lifestyle, but in fact you've got a problem which can profoundly affect your outlook 20 or 30 years from now?
We do have evidence from very well-conducted studies in type 1 diabetes that show that if we improve the glucose control, we use a measure, the A1C.
This is a measure of your control over the previous 3 months.
On average, across populations, that will read about 4 to 6% in people who do not have diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, we know from very well-conducted studies that if we can get that A1C to about 7%, or a little lower if it can be done safely, that we can significantly reduce the risk of complications.
This is the risk of blood sugar going too low and you having blackouts and maybe yourself and maybe doing some long-term damage.
Yes, in the short term, it is actually a limiting factor in how we can treat the condition for many people. However, I think, Norman, there's another important cost, and that is that the cost of asking someone, it's different for somebody such as your guest last week, Troy, or Richard Bernstein, or other people I know who have chosen a low carbohydrate diet, It's different for them as opposed to us to say to somebody, we are going to require you to eat a very low carbohydrate diet. So the cost of imposing on somebody a diet that is very different to what they would naturally choose, very different to what their peers are choosing, and this is particularly important for teenagers, but indeed for all of us, or very different to what we generally believe to be a reasonably balanced diet.
So, Martin, you're taking a pragmatic view, is that it's a step too far for many people. You're already going to go onto insulin. Going onto a low-carb diet is just going to change their lifestyle so much. But my question to you then is, if you're highly motivated and you decide you want to go onto a low-carbohydrate diet as well as injecting yourself with insulin, is there any evidence of harm? And what's the evidence of benefit?
If somebody wishes to follow a very low carbohydrate diet or even a moderately low carbohydrate diet, my reading of the literature is that there is no evidence of significant harm. But because there has been no really good systematic study of it, we don't know that it is beneficial. But if you take something out of a diet, you need to substitute something in. And we just don't know enough about what happens if we make that much higher protein or much higher fat, particularly the wrong sort of fats. I would also just like to caution anyone who wishes to change their diet radically who has type 1 diabetes that it is important to actually have that done with supervision or at least with recognition that there may be a rather major change in the amount of insulin they require.
Potentially going to Tiger Country, don't do it as a freelance activity.
That would be my advice.
And just briefly, Martin, because we're almost out of time. What about type 2 diabetes? Entirely different problem where you've got too much insulin because the body's not responding to it. But people are arguing that a low-carb diet is the way forward there because it will empty out the fat cells and actually reduce insulin resistance. What's the evidence that a low-carb diet's good for type 2?
Again, the problem here is that we don't have any good long-term evidence. We do have some good dietary studies looking at prevention of type 2 diabetes. The best study, from my perspective, is one called the Finnish Diabetes Prevention Study. In that study, carbohydrate was not low. Total fat content was kept below 30%. Saturated fat content was kept low. And there was a 60% reduction in the risk of people who were at very high risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
So this was essentially a calorie-controlled diet.
And very importantly, a physical activity component. We can achieve significant prevention without carbohydrate restriction. If we look through Southeast Asia, we know that many of the people in Southeast Asia have had traditionally high carbohydrate diets. And it's only more recently, with the more ready availability of higher protein, higher fat, and a calorie excess, that they are moving on to developing higher rates of type 2 diabetes. So I think for type 2 diabetes, a practical, simple message for people is activity and calorie control, and then we start getting to the finer points within the diet. But for most people who are overweight or at risk of type 2 diabetes, activity and calorie reduction would go a long way to achieving most of the benefit that we need to achieve.
Martin Kemp, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Martin Kemp, who's an endocrinologist from Brisbane, and he's also president of Diabetes Queensland and a past president of the Australian Diabetes Society. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been a very healthy health report. I'll see you next time.